Audio Service, National Radio Club.
Welcome to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service for February 2012. This is issue number 323. We have a new address for the DX Audio Service. It's actually our old address, 706 Mackenzie Drive, spelled M-A-C-K-E-N-Z-I-E. That's in Lima, Ohio, 45805-1835. Telephone number is 419-228-6223 for short calls only. Best time to call is between 7 and 9 p.m. during the weekdays and anytime on the weekends. A yearly cassette subscription to the DX Audio Service for U.S. Canadian members is $28. Tapes are sent via first-class mail, and you keep your cassettes. To subscribe or renew, make your check payable to the National Radio Club Incorporated and send them to me at the address that I just mentioned, or log on to our website at www.nrcdxas.org and sign up using PayPal. If you're on the Internet, you can also sign up to EDXN and get your DX Audio Service in MP3 format. A subscription to EDXN is only $15. Just point your browser to www.e-dxn.com and subscribe online with PayPal, but subscribe only if you're able to download and navigate a website without any assistance. And again, I'd like to remind you to change your address book so that you have the new address for the DX Audio Service, actually our old address, and we can stay in touch with each other, and hopefully by the next edition, we'll have an email. Right now, we're going to switch it over to Dave Alpert with a look at the AM switch. And at the end of this side, we should have some information about a contest. Dave?
This is the AM switch.
Welcome to the February 2012 edition of AM switch. We have four editions of AM switch to get through, so let's jump right into call letter changes. 560 WVOC Columbia, South Carolina becomes WXBT 910 in Oakland, California. A long time KNEW call sign becomes KKSF. But wait, 960 KKGN in Oakland now becomes KNEW. So it appears there is a little call swapping going on. Also on 960, the new CP in Mississauga, Ontario becomes CKNT. 890 KDJQ in Meridian, Idaho is KYWN now. 1210 WSKR Denham Springs, Louisiana becomes WLRO. 1270 WEIC in Charleston, Illinois, now WRJM. 1510 KMYN Isleta, New Mexico is now KOAZ. And 1560 WMBE New Holstein, Wisconsin becomes WLWB. FCC Actions 600 WBOB in Jacksonville, Florida applies for U2 20,000 watts during daytime, 9,700 watts at night. 610 KVLE Vail, Colorado is on the air under a special temporary authorization with U1 217 watts day and night using an information station specialist's loaded whip antenna 25 feet above an existing building. The station reports their tower was accidentally destroyed and they have lost the use of the licensed site. 1360 WBYO Tallulah, Louisiana, licensed for U1 500 watts day, 131 watts night. KBYO has been silent since October as they lost the lease on their land their transmitter and tower sits on. They're now operating D1 200 watts daytime only under an STA while they negotiate for a new site. 1370 WFDR Manchester, Georgia has had their CP granted for U1 2300 watts day, 28 watts at night. The new station in Garapan, Saipan on 1440 now has the call sign KKMP and is now on the air with U1 1100 watts day and night from the tower of KCNM 1080 in Saipan. For those of you who don't know where Saipan is located, it's a U.S. territory roughly 3,500 miles east of the Philippines, 4,000 miles north of Australia, and 8,000 miles west of Hawaii. 1550 WCLY, Raleigh, North Carolina, licensed for U1, 1,000 watts a day, 7 watts at night. WCLY's tower collapsed in May of 2011. and they've operated under an STA with D1, a kilowatt daytime only, from the temporary antenna since then. This action extends the STA for another 6 months, probably to get into better weather before they erect a new tower. Applications, 780 WAVA, Arlington, Virginia, has applied for D1, 5,000 watts day, critical hours power, 4,000 watts for auxiliary purposes. 920 WMNI in Columbus, Ohio, applies to change their city of license to Westerville, Ohio. Westerville is on the northeast side of Columbus along I-71 that goes toward Cleveland. 950 KRWZ, Denver, applies for U4 from U3, 5,000 watts day and night, as well as a city of license change to Parker, Colorado. Parker is a southeastern suburb of Denver. 970 WDAY, Fargo, North Dakota, applies for U4, 10,000 watts day and night. They were 5,000 watts day and night. 1210 KOKK, Huron, South Dakota, applies for U4, 5,000 watts day, 870 watts at night. 1580 KGAL, Lebanon, Oregon, applies for U4, 7,500 watts daytime, 1,000 watts night. And 1600 KNWA, Bellefont, Arkansas, applies for U1, a kilowatt day, 50 watts at night. They're decreasing their day power from 5,000 to 1,000 watts. Application amendments, 1060 KFOY, Sparks, Nevada. This new, still unbuilt station has a CP for U4, 15,000 watts day, 370 watts night. They then applied for U4, 10,000 watts day and 250 watts night. This newest amendment requests U7, 10,000 watts day, 250 watts night, and adds critical hours power of 10,000 watts. Dismissals and deletions, 890 KJME, Fountain, Colorado, new station not yet on the air, has a CP for U4, 5,000 watts day and 580 watts night. They amended the request to U4, 5,000 watts day and 640 watts night, which has been dismissed by the FCC. 1340 KRHC, Burnett, Texas, license canceled, call sign deleted. You can scratch this station out of the logbooks as it is gone for good. Here and there, gossip from everywhere. Reported as silent, WGFP 940, Webster, Massachusetts. KJMU 1340, Sand Springs, Oklahoma, due to a dispute with the owner of the land on which their transmitter and tower are located. CFXG 1230, Grand Cache, Alberta. CHLW 1310, St. Paul, Alberta. They went silent immediately after the CHSPFM 92.7 sign-on. WBLA 1440, Elizabethtown, North Carolina, KRDH 1510, Canton, Texas, and WLWB 1530, New Holstein, Wisconsin. Here's the backstory on that one. That's the station that got the new city of license and call letters, formerly WMBE, Chilton, Wisconsin. It seems the old tower had some structural problems, so something had to be done. A new tower is being built several miles away, but the owners, Metro North Communications, had to remove the old one. And the best way to do that? Break the guy wires and let it fall. The Fox affiliate in Green Bay, WLUK-TV, showed up with a camera crew. This is according to RBR.com. They have the video on their website. They say that the station will be back on the air in April from the new tower with the new call letters. Returning to the airwaves, WIOO, 1000 kilohertz, Carlisle, Pennsylvania. They had gone silent due to a station fire, but they're back on the air using borrowed equipment from other area stations. WGSF 1030 in Memphis, Tennessee, has returned with regional Mexican programming as Radio Ambiente. WJUL 1230, Hiawassee, Georgia, with Talk. And WRJD 1410, Durham, North Carolina, which was reported as silent with no reason given, but then they returned. Fines to report. A couple. Capstar Incorporated, owners of WGVL 1440 and WLFJ 660, both Greenville, South Carolina, as well as three area FM stations, fined $14,000 for EEO rules violations. MHR License LLC, the owners of WGH 1310 Newport News, Virginia, in addition to four area FM stations, fined $8,000 for EEO rules violations. And we close out AM Switch this month with some statistics to wind up 2011. The Federal Communications Commission reports that as of December 31st, there were 4,766 AM radio stations on the air in the United States, 6,542 FM commercial stations, 3,644 FM educational stations, 6,099 FM translators and boosters, 838 low-power FM stations, a total of 21,889 radio stations. Add to that the 8,522 TV stations in all classes for a grand total of 30,411 broadcast facilities under FCC jurisdiction. The big question is, how many have you heard? With thanks to Sean Axelrod, Doug Beard, Andrew Blade, Bruce Conti, Tom Hartloff, Dave Schmidt, Tony Fitzherbert, Dale Park, and Bruce Winkleman for their ears and notifying us of changes to the AM switch, I'm Dave Alford in the West Coast studios of the DX Audio Service, sending it over to Mark Durenberger in cold, snowy Minnesota.
Thanks, Dave, and I hope you're looking over my shoulder for errors in reporting as we continue to chronicle radio history in the greater Los Angeles area. Last month, we agreed that in order to make this report of reasonable length, we'd have to trim the station list to those within a couple of dozen miles of downtown. That still leaves some smaller stations on the side of the road, however. But last time, we had talked our way through 980 KFWB, and that would take us to 10Q, KTNQ on 1020. Began life as KFVD in 1925, and by 1928 had been on 1400, 1440, 1410, and 1390, all at 250 watts, and time-sharing. A move to 1,000 followed at a kilowatt, then NARBA put them on 1020 with the 1 kilowatt hours limited to protect KDKA. In 1944, the station was allowed 5 kilowatts and then 10, subject to KDKA protection, and they built a 2-tower directional to provide that protection. In 1959, Storer Broadcasting took over the station, changing the call to KGBS. And the station was authorized 50 kilowatts DAD. For a while in the 60s, they tried a beautiful music format, then switched to country in 1965, known as the Giant. But they were still a daytimer, and at sunset, they'd encourage folks to swing to their sister FM station. Interestingly, they were allowed to come back on early Monday mornings when KDKA was off for maintenance. In 1969, the station switched to a pop rock format that included Brazilian music, movie themes, even a woman-oriented quasi-talk morning show with Bill Balance. By the end of the 60s, pending the breakup of the Clear Channels, KGBS had 500 watts post-sunset authority. Once 1020 had been broken down as a clear, KGBS filed for 50 kilowatts full-time. That was in 1972. By 1973, the station tired of its soft pop format and went back to country. The explosion occurred in 1976 when KGBS became 10Q, top 40, going right after KHJ. The differential was that 10Q played punk rock and the new music, while KHJ stayed with its formula of proven cuts. 10Q stole the real Don Steele and Machine Gun Kelly from KHJ, but the format was short-lived. In 1979, the station was sold to K-Love Broadcasting and flipped to Spanish. Today it's a Univision operation. Anecdotally, there exists a story about a protection deal struck with KCK and Roswell, New Mexico, wherein Roswell supposedly altered its pattern to allow KTNQ to let theirs out a bit. 10Q's signal is directed mostly to the west and into the Pacific Ocean. KNX comes up next at 1070. One story holds that the station came on actually before KDKA in September 1920 when Fred Christian, an ex-Marconi shipboard wireless operator on the Middlesex in 1919, put together a 5-watt transmitter in his Hollywood home with the call letters 6ADZ. Christian began broadcasting on September 10, 1920, playing recorded music borrowed from music stores in return for plugs on the air. The first official call letters were KGC, listed with the feds on 890 with 500 watts, and the call became KNX early in the 20s. The 1928 frequency shuffle was easy on KNX, one move at 5 kilowatts from 890 to 1050. Shortly, KNX had experimental authorization for 25 kilowatts, and by 1934, they had 50,000 going into the antenna. CBS bought the station in 1936, thumbing its nose at a long and useful association with Don Lee, as we noted in an earlier report. NARBA, of course, moved KNX to 1070, and they were among the Southern California stations authorized to play with subaudible tones to control the area's air raid sirens. During the Golden Age, KNX was heavily network-oriented and served as the Western flagship for CBS, originating a number of popular network radio shows. They gradually moved the station toward news, adopting an all-news format in 1968, and thus ended up head-to-head with KFWB, until CBS purchased KFWB 980 and the news operations were merged. With KFWB's move to News Talk, KNX now owns the identity All News All the Time. In the 1960s, KNX added a second tower to experiment with daytime directional operation, not as a means of protecting anyone else, since they're the only Class A station on 1070, but rather to help penetrate the market. The experiment didn't work out, and unfortunately, much of their signal feeds the fishies. But they do present a dominant nighttime signal to the western third of the country. The aforementioned KDIS call letters, once on 710, now make their home on 1110. This channel made a lot of history in Southern California as KRLA. The signal came up on 1110 in 1941 as KPAS, serving Pasadena. Their 5 kilowatts was increased to 10, and the call changed to KXLA during World War II. In 1959, the colorful Jack Kent Cook purchased the signal and changed the call to KRLA, increasing the power to 50 kilowatts day and 10 at night. KRLA went top 40 and head-to-head with KFWB Channel 98. As we noted earlier, KHJ came on the scene in 1965, creating a three-way race for top 40 dominance. The first to drop out was KFWB, and in the late 60s, it was KRLA versus the boss. Meanwhile, owner Jack Kent Cook was in trouble. The launch of KRLA was accompanied by large cash prize promotions, one of which turned out to be a fraudulent contest. The FCC turned a new eye on Cook, looking into whether he was in fact a U.S. citizen when he bought the station. They pulled his license in 1962, but Cook formed a consortium that could continue to operate KRLA. A gang of 21 applicants filed for the frequency assignment the FCC had invalidated. That number was cut to 5 by negotiations, and the eventual winner was Bob Hope's Pasadena Broadcasting. Meanwhile, some of KRLA's best days were happening on the air on 1110, including some cool promotions, like the free transistors pre-tuned to 1110 that were given away everywhere, and badges that said, KRLA, stick it in your ear. But AM Rock gradually succumbed to FM in the basin, and by 1984, the station was moving toward an oldies format. The last pop song was played in 1998. The station tried talk for a couple of years, then flipped to sports as KSPN AM in 2000. And in 2002, the latest owner, CBS, did a call letter swap. KSPN went to 710, and KDIS in the Disney format moved to 1110, where it resides today. KTLK is one of only two full-power stations on Regional 1150 in the U.S. of A. They took to the ether in 1927 as KMIC, and like a number of these long-time stations, had several call letter changes. Their first air signal was actually on 1150 at 250 watts. Their only frequency changes were to 1340 and 1120 when NARBA finally moved them to 1150 in 1941. The first call letter change was in 1930 when they became KMCS. 2 years later, you found them as KRKD. During the 30s, KRKD shared tower and broadcast time with KFSG, the Four Square Gospel station, about which we'll learn more in just a moment. They did that time sharing until the late 1960s. KRKD slowly added power, and in the early 40s, they were 5 kilowatts day, 1 at night. They added a directional antenna and got to 5 kilowatts full-time in the late 70s. In 1970, with new ownership, now part of Gannett, the KRKD AM call letters changed to KIIS, KISS, and the format was soft rock with jingles performed by Richard and Karen Carpenter. It was known as the KISS of California, mostly a simulcast in a way of KISS FM, as we'll hear. In 1975, the station became KPRZ, K-Praise, and tried leaning toward Christian music. Then around 1981, 710 KMPC dropped its adult standards format and fired its DJs, who went to KPRZ with the music of your life. Well, it could only happen in radio. KMPC went back to standards a few years later, and that hit KPRZ. So KPRZ ended its standards format and became KISS AM again in 1985. It was transmitting its programming in AM stereo with an AM version of the jingle packages which had been produced for KISS FM. KISS AM carried a virtual simulcast of its FM programming, although with different DJs, to avoid FCC restrictions on simulcasting. In 1997, KISS AM became Sports Radio KXTA, the flagship station of the Los Angeles Dodgers. In 2003, KXTA, by this time a Clear Channel station, was falling off the leaderboard and had lost the Dodgers to KFWB. So KXTA flipped to Extra Sports, this time simulcasting with 690 AM, the successful X-Train San Diego. In 2005, Clear Channel conducted one of their multi-tentacled format swaps of three radio stations in the area. The Extra Sports format moved to AM 570, where, as we noted earlier, it retains its call letters of KLAC. And 1150 moved toward talk, and that's where they are today. A smaller voice in Los Angeles contributed nicely to radio history. Even though it's a kilowatt on a graveyard 1230, the station has an interesting story to tell. Currently known as KYPA, it's now a Korean language station. The first call was KGFJ, heard in 1927 on 1375 kilocycles. Moved to 1390, 1440, 1410, 1420, 1200. Time sharing all the way. Back then, their 100 watts was worth something, but they weren't able to improve the signal until the late 1940s. After all the frequency changes, NARBA settled them permanently on 1230. KGFJ was authorized a shortwave transmitter and was allowed to rebroadcast the 1936 Olympics via German shortwave to hear track star Jesse Owens triumph over Hitler's Germans and the rest of the athletic world. While the FCC approved a call letter change from 1977 to 1979 to KKTT, there's no record of those call letters anywhere else. In 1939, going back again, KGFJ became the first station in the country to broadcast 24 hours. Until 2004, the station operated from a flat-top antenna on the top of a building, and with its limited reach, had to develop its formats to fit the core inner-city market its signal was reaching. In later years, the station billed itself as the sound of success, and its puny power aside, it reached high ratings numbers in the Los Angeles urban market, with jazz, R&B, gospel, and black urban formats, garnering a National Broadcasting Excellence Award. In 1998, the station became KYPA, in search of personal achievement, and graduated to ethnic programming, which it airs today. The flat-top antenna? In 2004, the station tried diplexing on the tower of KBLA 1580. It didn't work, so they went back to the flat top. As of today, the FCC records still show KYPA using an inverted L rooftop ground. Next, the story of KWKW, first on the air with a kilowatt on 1300 in the late 1940s as KAGH, switched to KWKW in 1950, and eventually built out the 1300 facility to 5 kilowatts day, 2500 night from a DA2 array. For much of its life, the station provided a Spanish format. Around 1990, KWKW 1300 and KFAC 1330 swapped calls and formats with new ownership. KFAC Classical became ethnic KAZN in the move to 1300. The 1330 facility, where KWKW moved, had come up in 1922 on 1020 as KTBI. They did the hopscotch to 1040, 1090, and then to 1300, where they timeshared with KGEF. Eventual power was about a kilowatt. Then in 1930, the station changed its call to KFAC and asked for the removal of KGEF. They were authorized 1300, 1 kilowatt in 1932, but only half-time operation. 1941's NARBA gave them full-time, moved them to 1330, and authorized 5 kilowatts DA night. So as the 1990 swap came about, 1330's KFAC found itself on 1300, and KWKW took over 1330. The early KWKW formats included La Mexicana. Then in 2004, KWKW signed a contract with ESPN and carried a number of area pro sports games in Spanish. Today, KWKW 1330 is branded as ESPN Deportes 1330. KAZN today is AM 1300 Radio Chinese. Well, because our friendly electronic warden is watching the clock, we're going to need to skip the stories of KMZT, KFRN, KLTX, KMRB, KYTM, and others. That lands us back at the KMPC call letters, now hanging out on 1540. The original call on this channel was KPOL. KPOL came on the air with, you guessed it, polka music about 1952. The station became KZLA Country in 1980. 4 years later, they were KSKQ Spanish, and those call letters lasted until 1993, when the station was known as KXED or KXEZ, not sure which. 3 years was enough for those call letters. Next was KXMG. KXMG Mega 1540 lasted but 1 year, and the station flipped to sports as KCTD. Confused yet? Another call letter changed 3 years later in 2001 to KMPC, still sports, and the station went ethnic in 2007. 1540 has a 50-kilowatt authorization daytime with a signal generally west and south and a nighttime authorization of 37 kilowatts, mostly south, protecting Seattle, Waterloo, and ZNS. That leaves a look at 1580 and Santa Monica's 50-kilowatt KBLA. The station had humbler beginnings as 5-kilowatt KOWL in the early 1950s. The format was a mix of American and ethnic programming. A few years later, the call became KDAY, and the power was increased to 50 kilowatts, still daytime. During the KDAY days, the station had top 40, rap, hip-hop, and urban music going. None of it did well, so in 1991 and for the following 6 years, it was a business news outlet, KBLA. The station went ethnic in 1997 and pure Spanish in 2004 after a short flirtation with Air America. The KBLA signal is now 50 kilowatts at night as well. And the station's energy is sent toward the Pacific Islands because they have to protect co-channel 50-kilowatter KMIK in Tempe, Arizona. Today, KBLA is branded as Radio Zion. And normally we'd call it quits right about now, but we wanted to leave room for the story of the Four Square Gospel Broadcasting Company and Sister Amy Semple McPherson. To tell the story about Amy and Four Square Gospel, we snip from Jim Hilliker's history of KFSG. He says, with so many radio stations to choose from in Los Angeles, I suppose a station like KFSG could have been lost in the shuffle by today's radio listeners. But one thing is certain, there never would have been a KFSG without Amy Semple McPherson, the woman evangelist who got the station on the air in 1924.
Come unto me, all ye that are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest.
Today, if some people know her name, it's only because of an infamous kidnapping scandal in 1926, in which the press accused her of running off for a while with her former engineer. Sister Amy began the Four Square Gospel Church in Los Angeles in 1918. Between 1920 and 22, she traveled with her mother on a nonstop series of evangelistic services. The purpose of those trips was to preach the Word of God and to raise money to build her home church in L.A. The 5,300-seat Angelus Temple opened in 1923. 1 year later, the church would have its own radio voice. Sister Amy, as her followers called her, was no stranger to innovation and controversy. One website on her life claims that Amy McPherson's weakness was men, and that she had several affairs, some discreet and some not so discreet. With her personality and style of preaching, Amy turned the religious establishment of that time upside down. Mrs. McPherson was written about in newspapers and magazines and was called everything from the Barnum of religion to the Mary Pickford of revivalism. Humorist Will Rogers commented on the Angelus Temple.
Sister Amy McPherson baptizes 100,000 out here every Sunday. Of course, it's the same 100,000 she uses every Sunday, but that's not bad. Bad baptizing, is it? She's got a ducking machine here where you duck 50 at a time.
In January of 1924, the Department of Commerce Radio Division wired Amy that her license for the new station was granted, with the sequentially issued call letters KFNC. She immediately fired off a reply telegram asking that her radio station be called KFSG, as her church called its teachings the Four Square Gospel. A telegram came back granting her request, and her station was called KFSG, assigned to 1080 kilocycles. The station was built on the third floor of Angelus Temple, with its transmitting antenna on the church roof. It was an immediate success. Besides the thousands of radio fans who tuned into KFSG each week, the station was also drawing the attention of the Department of Commerce. One legend is that KFSG was taken off the air, or at least received a stern warning, because the station used either too much power, drifted off its assigned frequency, or changed frequencies without permission. If Amy was allowing KFSG to use other frequencies than the one she was assigned to broadcast on, she was not alone. There were plenty of newspaper stories in the mid-20s, especially in larger eastern cities, about radio stations moving up or down the dial to escape interference from other stations. In response to these warnings from the radio regulators, at some point, a frustrated Mrs. McPherson fired off an angry telegram to Secretary of Commerce Herbert Hoover. Quote, "Please order your minions of Satan to leave my station alone. You cannot expect the Almighty to abide by your wavelength nonsense. When I offer up my prayers, I must fit into the receiving sets in heaven. You don't know their wavelengths, and neither do I. So stop interfering with me at once." Well, perhaps coincidentally, the station suddenly began to behave itself. Then there was the kidnapping. In 1926, Amy went for a swim at Ocean Park during a day of relaxing at the beach and writing some sermons. She was not seen again all day. At first, it was feared that McPherson had drowned in the surf, but a search for her body turned up nothing. And then on June 23rd, Amy reappeared in Douglas, Arizona, across from the Mexican border, with a story that she had been kidnapped from the beach and held captive, but had somehow managed to escape. Suspicion led to a grand jury investigation in Los Angeles with charges of perjury and manufacturing evidence. After a lengthy trial, the charges were dismissed. It may be that Sister Amy salted the jury pool, telling her story as she wanted it told every night on KFSG. Sister Amy also had to deal with the changes the new Federal Radio Commission was making. In 1928, the commission forced KFSG into a timeshare arrangement on 1190 with station KEJK. This meant KFSG could not go on the air whenever Amy decided. Then on November 11, 1928, the FRC made the first major national reallocation of the AM broadcast band, assigning stations to operate on clear regional or local channels. They decided to move KFSG from 1190 to 1120, sharing time with KMIC Englewood. That station, as we just heard, became KRKD, today's K-Talk 1150. By the mid-30s, KFSG, along with timeshare partner KRKD, had increased their daytime transmitting power to 2,500 watts, while night power remained at 250. After a colorful and controversial career, Sister Amy Semple McPherson died of a drug overdose in 1944. KFSG died of natural causes, the changing radio environment, in 2003, after 79 years of checkered service. And there we part company, folks, because in part and by patch, the state of the stations in Los Angeles is completed. I'm only sorry we couldn't have told you more and included the several perhaps lesser-known stations. But the clock is an arduous slave driver, isn't it? Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service. In 30 days or so, we'll bring you some of the results of a recent beverage de-expedition in the frozen north of the upper Midwest. Until then, good listening, DXers.
Thanks, Mark. Now it's time for an exclusive NRC giveaway opportunity. A 2012 World Radio TV Handbook for only $3. That's right, for the cost of an envelope and media rate postage, a 2012 WRTH can be yours. This drawing is open to all National Radio Club members except the Chairman of the Board of Directors and our International DX Digest Editor. Regardless of the publication you receive, DX News Magazine, DX Audio Service, or edxn.com. The National Radio Club has been a supplier of the United States and Canada data to WRTH for a number of years. Part of our compensation has been a couple free books each year for use in prizes in our contests. And we provide one to our IDXD editor for use in the preparation of his column, so Bruce is excluded. This year, we received our allotment and the club has three left over. So what better way to distribute them than to members in a random drawing fashion? To keep the playing field level, all those wishing to participate in the drawing need only send a letter with their intent to enter, stating their willingness to pay the postage and handling from Aurora, Colorado, to their location. The minimum is $3 via USPS media rate. More can be negotiated if priority or overseas shipping is required, with our apologies to overseas members. Please include a phone number and the best time to call, and winners will be notified by mail. Mail this letter to the National Radio Club, WRTH Drawing, Post Office Box 473251, Aurora, Colorado, 80047-3251. It must arrive and be removed from our Post Office Box the morning of March 1st, 2012. The letters go into a box and will have a disinterested third party, a respected official of the radio-oriented organization, draw three winners. Only one letter per member, please. It's simple and easy. Take a chance to win yourself a 2012 WRTH handbook.
You're listening to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service.
The following is by Wayne Faulkner of the Wilmington Star News on December 5th, 2011. New radio station to play all classical all the time. Some might think it's counterintuitive to convert a Wilmington area Spanish language station to a classical format, but the radio station's top executive said classical is a good complement to his company's current stations. The new station, WSFM 1180 AM, and translator W240AS, known as Bach Radio, began operations November 22nd. Davis Media bought the station along with three others, the Penguin 98.3 FM, the Big Talker 93.7 FM, and the Bone 103.7 FM, from Connecticut-based Seacom Media last month. When we looked at the demographics, the Spanish-language audience only represented 4% of the market, said Jake Russell, equity owner and general manager of Hometown Wilmington Media, which runs the stations. Bringing an all-classical format to Wilmington surprised some, as classical stations have taken a big hit in numbers nationwide in the last two decades. I think when you get right down to it, some of the classical formats that have gone away may have had scenarios that were very expensive, Russell said. His station is supported by advertising rather than public contributions and grants that some stations use in other markets. The 28-year-old WHQR, on the other hand, is run by a local nonprofit, Friends of Public Radio. All decisions are made locally, said Steve Cleve Callison, the station manager. WHQR is a member station of National Public Radio, offering syndicated news, but Wilmington area news is locally hosted, as is its daytime classical music, the latter by Jamelia Erickson and Pat Marriott, Callison said. Nighttime and weekend classical music is syndicated, he said. At Bach Radio, the on-air personalities and the music are syndicated from the World Classical Network out of Cape Cod, and saves the expense of hiring announcers and providing extra facilities, Russell said. Additionally, our format is familiar classical, and we're treating it like a regular music format. It just happens to be classical. Russell previously described the station as classical top 40. Though its music is provided remotely, Russell promised that the station would offer news, weather, and sports. That hasn't happened yet, though. He said he hopes news will start after the first of the year. Davis Media has been running a classical station in Williamsburg, Virginia, also dubbed Bach Radio, for 6 years. Citing Simmons research, Russell said Bach Radio's audience is evenly spread from ages 18 through 65. The percentage of people who have attended college and their household income add to its attractiveness to advertisers, he said, adding that the average time spent listening to classical is longer than other stations. Bach Radio's signal remains weak in some locations, especially near the edges of its range. Russell said that the FM station has a 250-watt translator, so it's not a full-power operation, he said. It's unlikely to increase in power, Russell said, but we are looking at streaming on the Internet. Again, that article comes from the Wilmington Star News, December 5th, 2011, via DX Audio Service member Bruce Conti. For the DX Audio Service, I'm Bruce Winkleman.
It's been a long time since we've had a CPC test, so let's jump right into this one. We've got two tests. First of all, WTKT Radio, 1460 in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, will conduct a DX test on Monday morning, February the 27th, at 12:15, 12:45, 1:15, 1:45, 2:15, 2:45, 3:15, 3:45, 4:15, and 4:45 Eastern Time for 1 minute. The test will consist of voice announcements and Morse code identifications. Also, WHP Radio 580 in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania will be conducting a DX test on Monday morning, February the 27th at 12:05, 12:33, 1:05, 1:33, 2:05, 2:33, 3:05, 3:33, 4:05, and 4:33 Eastern Time for 1 minute. This test will consist of voice announcements and Morse code identifications. Operations Manager R.J. Harris is also investigating the possibility of using the daytime antenna patterns during the tests. Reception reports and digital audio recordings may be directed to R.J. Harris, all one word, R-J-H-A-R-R-I-S, at clearchannel.com. DXers can receive a WHP or WTKT QSL card for correct reception reports by sending the reports along with a self-addressed stamped envelope and or return postage to the following address: Mr. R.J. Harris, Operations Manager, WHP Radio, 600 Corporate Circle, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, 17110. And thanks to R.J. Harris, who is also an amateur radio operator, call sign W3HP, for doing these tests. And thank you to test arrangers J.D. Stevens and Jim Pogue.
From Radio World, Choice chooses Cold War broadcast book. Sometimes a book escapes our notice, but thanks to the American Library Association's online review journal, Choice, Cold War Broadcasting, Impact on the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, attracts new attention. The publication picked that book as one of 2011's outstanding academic titles. Published by the Central European University Press, it was edited by A. Ross Johnson and R. Eugene Parta, both veterans of Radio Free Europe. With sections written by radio broadcasters and scholars, Johnson and Parta examined the broadcast part of the soft conflict during the Cold War. According to the publisher, their contributors are able to take advantage of newly declassified material, along with access to now accessible populations that were the target audience of Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty. Topics include overall broadcast goals, programs for individual countries, the audience, jamming attempts, and other countermeasures by authorities, and estimates of effectiveness. The Slavic Review says, in recent years, Cold War studies have undergone a modest revolution. In addition to the many political, diplomatic, and military books and articles on the Cold War, a few scholars have begun to focus on the importance of soft power in the conflict. Cold War Broadcasting is a welcome addition to that small but growing body of scholarship. The articles and documents provide a wealth of new information that lays the foundation for a critical analysis of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberties, and other Western broadcasters' impact on the Soviet Union and its satellites in Eastern Europe. The Russian Review says, now we have this wonderful book to explain to us how the voices functioned, what their problems and successes were, how jamming worked, and what the authorities were worried about. Here in one thick volume, we have the inside story of so many issues that surfaced during the Cold War, when information beamed to this part of the world was arguably the West's most dangerous weapon. Cold War Broadcasting does not read like a novel, although the material is dramatic and exciting enough for many novels. And Choice said, this collection of documents and scholarly analysis marks a major advance in the discussion and furthers understanding the role of propaganda and reliable information in shaping the complex dynamics of the Cold War. Summing up, highly recommended. The book also contains a selection of translated documents from formerly secret Soviet and East European archives, most of them published here for the first time. The book is called Cold War Broadcasting, Impact on the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service.
At this time, please turn over your tape to side two.
WDGY, Minneapolis.